Hey guys, Melissa here. I blog at our family website, www.thecorkums.com, which we affectionately call the Corkboard. This is the Uncorked Podcast. If I had to choose a descriptor for our family, it would be outside the box. Whether it's adopting three unrelated adolescents out of birth order, or trying to run a coffee shop in our quote-unquote spare time right after adopting, we love adventure. We had to give up that coffee shop, and our three oldest kids are launched for now. But with lots of extended family living at home and a full-time wellness business, there still aren't many dull moments. We've met so many amazing people with fascinating stories along our journey. I'd love to introduce them to you. You are listening to Episode 8 of the Uncorked Podcast. This week, my guest is Erica Rimlinger. She shares her story of overcoming breast cancer, not once, but twice, and the crazy book that came out of it. You know that saying, real life is better than fiction? So true. Wait until you hear her story about Susie. Erica's sense of humor and braveness about her cancer journey challenge me every time I listen to her. You're going to love her. Plus, she also divulges her most embarrassing parent moment ever. I think she could probably win an award for it. And I talk a lot about sex. Probably too much. Are you ready? Let's jump in.
Well, hi, Erica. Welcome to the Uncorked Podcast. I'm so glad that you are humoring me enough to be here.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm thrilled.
Well, Erica, we've known each other for a long time, and we met during a stage of life that not a lot of people that I know now even know about me, but once upon a time, I was a fitness instructor.
Yes, and a mighty fine one as well.
And you're still doing, are you still doing that?
I am still doing that. I teach for the JCC. I teach a number of Les Mills programs. Sometimes I teach Zumba, and yeah, it's a lot of fun.
And so we were teaching together for a program called Stroller Strides, which I think is still called Stroller Strides, but it was like the best thing that ever happened to me when I had little kids. I remember trying to break into different mom groups, and they were all really snotty and really hard to break into until I went to Stroller Strides. And there was just this camaraderie, and I don't know, it was just amazing. I met a lot of my really great friends when I was trying to survive toddlerhood at Stroller Strides.
So did I. I don't know what it was about that program, but I mean, it was perfect. I mean, first of all, everybody was so nice. Second of all, it was the way I got out of bed in the morning or got dressed. You know, if I could make it to Stroller Strides by 9:30 a.m. and I had pants on, you know, that was a victory for me when my child was that age.
Yeah, and it kind of set the stage for a day. Like, you got up, you worked out first, and then you could kind of do whatever you needed to do. You kind of felt like you could conquer the world. And we got to hang out with other moms and hear other people's stories and watch their kids kind of like cry and scream through the class and feel like, you know, if they can do it, I can do it. And we had to hang out at the playground all day. And it was such
yeah.
a good time.
Yeah. And do you remember doing it at the zoo? Do you remember teaching at the zoo?
Yeah, the zoo, the science center. I mean, we really actually got access to a lot of cool places because we would go and have these early morning exercise classes before these places really opened. But then they really didn't kick you out like once they opened. So it's kind of like your free pass. If you could get your butt out of bed to go to like 9 o'clock workout at the zoo or the science center, then you could stay and play for free.
Oh, yeah, it was great. Although I'll never forget at the zoo, we would stop and do, you know, work with the exercise bands, and we would always stop in front of the cougars or the tigers, and the tigers would just sit there and look at our babies all lined up in their strollers, and just, you could read the little thought bubbles above their heads, like, ooh, breakfast. It was pretty funny, I thought.
Well, you know what, but that was better than like the weird looks we would get from like the mall walkers, because we would also work out in the mall. And when I think about it now, I think like that was insane. I mean, we would like full out do a workout class in the middle of the mall while walking the mall.
Yes. I think the mall walkers were jealous personally. I think they were just jealous of us. That's why they were giving us dirty looks.
I mean, we did look pretty amazing. Those were just great days. Great days for sure. Well, since then, you've had a lot happen, and I remember, I think, shortly after you retired from Stroller Strides, because that's the thing with Stroller Strides is unless you're going to have babies for infinity, kind of like Angie Feely, then you eventually stop teaching because you don't have a kid to push in the stroller anymore.
And right.
I remember seeing the news that you had been diagnosed with breast cancer, and I remember being devastated because you were really young and you were a fitness instructor, and all those things together just didn't make sense in my mind.
Yeah. It was quite a shock. I always tell my doctors, I say, you know, I am the healthiest sick person you'll ever meet in your life, you know, because they, you know, would give me these pamphlets and websites and, oh, here's some information on exercising and here's some information on nutrition. And then I'm like, yeah, I know. Thanks. Got it. Yeah, I'm sick anyway. I don't know why. So, and what was even more shocking was when it came back 2 years later. I thought, well, you know, I eat kale every day. I do this, I do that, you know. I was doing pretty much everything right, but it came back. And it was nobody was more shocked than I was. Although I must say, as a lifelong hypochondriac, I must say it was kind of vindicating. I can finally say, you know what? There really was something wrong. And now when I go to the doctor or I call the doctor and say, oh, there's this strange mark on my toe, you know, instead of the doctor blowing me off and saying, you know, oh, go away, Erica, you're just such a hypochondriac. Now the doctor says, come in. Can you come in right this minute? And I get to go in. It's kind of like a hypochondriac dream, really. So.
Yeah, I can see that. So how did you even find out that you had breast cancer? Was there a mammogram?
Oh, I found a lump. I was too young for mammograms. I was, well, not way too young, but 38 when I found it. I had been doing body pump and I had just finished the chest track and body pump, and I sat up and I thought to myself, that was a tough chest track. And I just put my hand right over my pectoral muscles and I felt something, and maybe it was my hypochondria, but I thought, well, that doesn't seem right. It was very different from anything that I had ever seen or felt before. It wasn't subtly different. It was very, very different. I mean, it felt like a very large grain of sand, whereas I guess most people have lumps. I had never really had lumps before, or bumps or anything. But it was just a very hard grain of sand right under my skin. And I don't know why. I kind of knew. Again, maybe it's because I'm a hypochondriac. Who knows? But, yeah. And I always get asked how I knew, and I guess the answer is I have no idea, but I really did. And I think it was just that gut feeling.
Yeah. Well, I think sometimes people who are really healthy and are doing all the things, sometimes you're also a lot more in tune to your body than maybe the general public. And so you know when something's off, like you kind of are in tune enough to know, like, that wasn't there before, or that doesn't feel right, or I've never felt that before. Always know when I'm getting sick, like coming down with something, like way before it really ever happens. It's like there's not even like a symptom I can put my finger on, but I just know, like, my body's going to be sick soon.
Yes, exactly. And that's how I found it the second time, too. I just put my hand right there and thought, oh, boy. I just kind of knew that something was off again. And I was pretty much in denial the second time, though. I said, oh, that can't be anything, even though I kind of knew deep down that it was. But you can always, I've learned how to read doctors' faces when they're looking for things on you. So it's been very useful to me. Like when I'm getting a, you know, CAT scan or sonogram, you know, or whatever they do to you, I look at their faces very intently, and I can tell if they're trying to put on a neutral face or not. So
that's so interesting. So what, I'm assuming that since you found it, did you find it early? What was the prognosis when you finally confirmed that it was in fact cancer?
Well, at first they thought I had found it early because it was just a small little thing, but then they found another piece of the cancer, and then they found another one and another one and another one. And I can't remember how many there were total, but there were just a ton of tumors in there, just so many. And they think it was one big tumor that had just kind of split apart. But they did catch it, I guess, kind of early because it didn't spread outside my lymph, outside my breast into my lymph system. So that was good.
Yeah, I feel like that's huge, like a huge hurdle. So what did your treatment look like?
The first time I had a mastectomy, and we couldn't decide, or we had to do it so fast that we couldn't line up reconstruction right away. So I just said, it was my decision, and I said, you know, let's just get this over with and I'll deal with that later. So we did the mastectomy, then I did chemo, and that was it. At the end, I got a little pamphlet that said, so you've survived cancer. And it talked about, of course, exercise and nutrition. And the second time was a lot more involved. It was, it came back in the same breast, which is pretty unusual, especially after you've had a mastectomy. It's called a chest wall recurrence, and it's pretty rare. So they did the surgery to take that out, and then I had a lot of chemo and a lot of radiation. They just kind of dumped the whole bucket of treatments on me for that one.
Wow. So had you not done reconstruction before you had round two?
Gosh, I don't even remember. I don't think I did. So I think I had that. Oh, yes, I had it afterwards because they wanted me to do it after radiation because they said radiation can sometimes mess things up.
Okay.
So after all that.
It's like a blessing in disguise that you didn't have, I guess, like a reconstruction on top of where a recurrence could have happened.
Oh, yeah. And I mean, I don't know how that happened, that we just happened to find it, and there it was, and I had been ready to get everything done, and yeah, I would have had to have it redone, so that was definitely very lucky.
So what was that process like? I have a friend kind of walking through this a little bit, and she has four kids, you have a kid. What was that like as a mom trying to deal with all the emotions of going to treatment, not feeling well, all of those things, and then still feeling like you had people to take care of?
Well,
did you
we
have
tried
like
to be
people come around you, and what
oh yeah, I
like
mean
for your family,
I'm really, really fortunate in that I have health insurance for one, and a great support system, and that was completely key. I mean, I had friends and family who rallied around me, and that was a huge help. I could just put something on Facebook like, help, can somebody pick up Max at school? And, you know, within 5 minutes, 20 responses. I mean, people were just amazing. It could bring me to tears. And with that kind of luck, it was hard to feel depressed a lot. I mean, some days were pretty depressing, but I mean, most of the time I was really being lifted up. And that was great. We tried to be very simple but honest with Max, and we got him involved. We let him cut my hair off. He gave me a mohawk. It was the scariest 5 minutes of my life. I thought he was going to cut off my ear. And I got a whole bunch of wigs, every color of the rainbow, and I would teach Zumba in them. So I had my pink wig, my purple wig, my blue wig, and that was a lot of fun. And Max would help me style my wigs and put glitter glue in them. Like it was like a craft project, really. So I guess we didn't take a whole lot of it that seriously. I mean, we obviously took the cancer very seriously, but the treatment side effects, I mean, it is what it is. Like you're going to lose your hair and you're going to do this. And I mean, of course I cried when I lost my hair and I was surprised that I did because I was so prepared for it. But after I cried, you know, my husband gave me a big hug and said, okay, well, you've been waiting for a chance to try on that pink wig. So let's do it. And then after that, you know, we just kind of went forward with it. And, oh, I also, since I work at the JCC, there's a huge Orthodox population there. And the Orthodox women, when they get married, they wear wigs out in public. And so this group of ladies gave me all of their old wigs. It was amazing, absolutely amazing. So I had different colored hair every single day. And all the things I had ever wanted to try with my hair, I got to do while I was bald. I found out that I can never be a blonde, even though I'd always wanted to be blonde. I look like a failed country western singer when I'm blonde. We were honest with Max, and we weren't, but not pessimistic. We were like, you know, we're really lucky to be alive during this time where we have so many options available to us. We live in Baltimore where we have access to Johns Hopkins, you know, like we're the fortunate ones. So there's no reason to, you know, at least we tried.
Yeah, no. And oh, yeah. I felt that through your social media posting. I love that about your story. And I think it totally fits your personality, and you kind of take things head on. And so that's amazing. And hysterical that I think your shirt would say, like, the scariest part of chemo was my son's mohawk or something like to that effect. Like, you know, that of all those things, like, that's what sticks out in your mind. Like, and I had chemo and I had to have surgery, but the scariest part was like when I let my kid cut my hair.
Oh yeah. Oh yeah. Absolutely.
So. Which I think says a lot about that whole mental state of where you were and really probably why you beat it twice, because I think mentality, mental health, you know, there's so much in mind over matter. And, you know, when you are going to fight that hard, then, you know, your body fights with you. So.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. So, and also I had a great role model. Cancer runs very deeply in my family. My Aunt Judy had, I think she's survived cancer 5 times now. But yeah, she had cancer she first got it when I was 16. And she went out and bought a big blue mohawk. It was the 80s, and she had a little fun with it. And so I guess I just kind of got my attitude from Aunt Judy. And I think to myself, well, you know what? We tend to get cancer a lot in our family, but we also tend to beat it too. So, you know?
I think that's like the definition of optimism right there. So while you're fighting cancer, you reconnect with a friend, and out of this comes this book, which if it wasn't so based in real life, I think would be, I don't know, it was hysterical to read, but like kind of horrifying all at the same time, because I knew that it was loosely based
on
your own experience.
Oh yeah. I like to say that the book that I wrote about that experience is 100% true, except for the parts I made up. So, yeah, I thought initially, because the story was so crazy and so out there, that I thought, well, I'll write about this. I mean, I guess I had to write about it just kind of to process the entire experience. I wanted to make it nonfiction at first and tell it like it happened, but I found that it was more helpful to me to make it fiction. and it was my book. So just in terms of processing, I ended up writing the story the way I wanted it to be instead of the way it was. And that kind of helped me with the sort through the what ifs and the, you know, writing fiction allowed me to do that.
Yeah, I think that's hugely therapeutic and cathartic. So remind me what the title of the book is. It's been a little over a year since I read it. And then just kind of what the premise is without giving too many spoilers. Because I think after people hear what you're about to say, they're going to run out and buy the book because it really is one of those reads. And it's a pretty quick read and kind of fun. And anyway, so just can you kind of recap a little bit like what the premise is?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. So it's called The Truth About Susie, and you can get it on Amazon. And it's about these two women who are fairly young, and they knew each other in childhood, and then they kind of fell out of touch. And one girl, Susie, was kind of a wild girl. She was very different from the other character, Cecily, who is just kind of a little bit nerdy, you know, that sort of thing. And Susie was always very wild. So Susie moves away, and then Cecily grows up, becomes a microbiologist, and gets diagnosed with breast cancer. And after she's diagnosed, she posts it on Facebook, and then Susie, who she hasn't seen in, you know, 20 years, 20-some years, sends her a message and says, oh, you have cancer too. Let's fight it together. So they kind of rekindle this friendship, but it's not very straightforward. Susie always seems like she's an actress and a musician in LA, and she's a very heavy partier, and she doesn't really answer a whole lot of Cecily's direct questions. Cecily will ask a question like, you know, when were you diagnosed and what's going on and et cetera, et cetera. And Susie will just start talking about random stuff and kind of deflect. But they become very close over the course of this internet relationship, very close with one another. And then there are a few spells where Susie kind of drops off the map. And then at one point, Cecily finds out through friends that Susie is dead. And that's enough of a shock. But the bigger shock is that she died of alcohol poisoning or alcoholism, and it was all filmed for a reality show one of those fake doctor shows. And so she watches the show, and sure enough, it's Susie. And so she has to go through all of their correspondence and figure out what really happened. Was she catfished? Did Susie never have cancer at all and was just lying to her the entire time? Or did she really have cancer? And if so, what happened? And why did she? Yeah, there are so many questions. She has so many questions. And as you can tell, I'm getting a little emotional about it because this is what really happened to me. This really happened. I mean, this is all true, all true. The fiction starts after Susie dies. Cecily goes to LA to try and figure out the truth about Susie and what their relationship was and what happened and was she lied to the entire time. And it just kind of deals with the issues of, well, of course, breast cancer, but also, you know, who can you trust in this Facebook age and era, you know? When you're reaching out there into the internet, it's a blessing because you can, you know, reach out to people from your past. You can connect with people, but really what's the quality of that connection and basically it's about that.
It's a huge conundrum, the social media world we're in. I feel you because on one hand, I love people. I love real life conversation. But on the other hand, when you're going through something, like in your case, breast cancer, in our family's case, adoption, social media is how you connect with the masses of people that are going through what you're going through, if it's an unusual situation, and make you feel not alone. And, you know, you can't always find those people in real life.
Oh, yeah.
At least not in the same way. But then I can't even imagine, you know, feeling that connection and then having it kind of all unravel and then not being left unsure. And so was that like a distraction for you while you were going through your treatment, like something that helped keep your mind off of all the other cancer stuff? Or was it just like additional stress, additional things to process?
Well, basically I was grieving. And writing the book helped me grieve. It helped me go through all the stages. It's not a depressing book by any means, because the real life Susie was absolutely hilarious. And, you know, it's very hard to cry when thinking about her, because she is just, or was just, I mean, just so much fun. And I mean, she really supported me and we supported each other. But yeah, it was a whole separate grieving process that was on top of. And but you know, that happens when you have cancer and you reach out and you talk to other people who have cancer. Not everybody is lucky enough to make it all the way through. I have people in my metastatic breast cancer support group at Hopewell. And, you know, you look around the room and you think, you know, like, some of us are going to beat this and, you know, some of us may not. It's definitely the sharp edge of reaching out to people who are in the same situation as you're in. It's one of the unique aspects of reaching out when you have cancer.
Yeah, what a sobering reality to have to face.
Yeah, yeah. So, yeah.
But also worth it. Would you say worth it to have those connections? I mean, I guess it's hard because, like you said, statistically speaking, when you look around a room in a support group like that, you know, it's devastating to, I guess, dwell on the sad side of that statistic. But then the flip side is, if, you know, we hold ourselves up and protect ourselves from that devastation, then we also miss. It's just like, you know, one of life's big paradoxes, I suppose.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, I mean, you're opening yourself up to potentially getting hurt and having to grieve. And the experience of having cancer and meeting a lot of people who have also fought that battle has made me a lot less afraid in life of negative emotions, of a lot of things, really. It's really, I don't know, I feel like a totally different person than I was as I went into cancer. I felt like before I had it, I was pretty much afraid of everything. You know, what if this happens? What if that happens? You know, I was a hypochondriac completely, and not just with my health, but with everything. I was always just, I don't know, I guess you could call it very neurotic, but, well, maybe not very, but a little bit. And I don't know, having that experience, you just think, well, I can control this, but I can't control that. And here we go. You know, you just have to, and be like, that's the difference between me at age 45 versus me at age 38. I don't sweat the small stuff. That's the difference. Usually. Not always, but usually. So
yeah, well, I guess it takes a kind of a crisis a lot of times to help put things in perspective.
Oh yeah,
in my life.
Yeah, it's a big slap upside the face. It's God's way of telling you to get your act together, you know. So yeah, you've been through that with the adoptions and everything as well.
Yeah, I mean, more in focus for our family, it's kind of the parenting thing. Like, we threw ourselves into the deep end with teenagers, and they were kind of extreme teenagers. So, like, now that we're raising, because Max is coming into teenagehood. And
yes.
he's about PJ's age, who is our first kid from scratch, we'll say, like the one that we, you know, from the beginning. And so we're moving through stages with him, and he feels like the first in some ways. But we've kind of also done some of these stages already with these older kids who we only had as older kids. But it's interesting how I think if I had not had the experience of our older kids, I would be such a neurotic mom, like to my like first time 14-year-old. You know, I would totally, my bent is to, you know exactly what you're doing all the time, like micromanage your life, you know, all the things.
Oh, yeah. Oh, it's a scary world out there with the internet and, you know, oh, crazy.
I know. And so, but I've had these big kids who, like, really, some of them had extreme behaviors. We had another foster, we housed another kid who had aged out of the foster care system who had, you know, run-ins with the law, all these things. And so after living through that with four kids, I'm, like, looking at the 14-year-old, and I'm like, eh, you'll be fine. Like, he started like, he started school this year. He's been homeschooled for 7 years, but he decided to go to public high school. So he starts school, which is, like, a pretty big deal. I was thinking about it, like, if I was trying to put myself in his shoes. Like, if I had been a freshman without knowing anyone in my high school situation, like how I would have reacted to that. And it like started to give me panic attacks. And I was like, okay, we can't go there. We're just going to have to pretend like he's going to be okay. And then my husband and I proceeded to go out of town for the first week of school. So we went to freshman orientation on Friday. And then the first day of school was Tuesday. Wednesday, we were like, peace, yo. And then he did the whole first week of school like on his own. And so he knew about it. He's a big kid. He's a great kid. He's really confident, and he was really okay with it all. But then, like, I'm panicking on the way to the other side of the country, and I'm thinking, like, oh, gosh, like, what if he needs a parent to sign something, you know, like a syllabus or some kind of agreement? Or, you know, what if he needs some school supplies? Because we didn't really go school supply shopping, because in high school, you don't get a school supply list like I remember getting in, like, elementary school, like, 3 months in advance. You like walk into school on the first day and they're like, and by the way, here's the supply list.
Oh my gosh.
So we're like playing this game while like I'm in Utah and my husband and I are both in Utah and he's here. And I'm like, quick, email me your supply list from today and I'll see if I can like Amazon overnight it to you.
Yeah. Holy moly. Wow.
But that's kind of the attitude we have now. Like, you know, I hope you get on the bus every morning. Like, see you next week.
Yeah. Oh, my gosh. I used to think that, the number 13 has always been considered unlucky, and I used to think that was pretty arbitrary. Now I know that it's not. Like, I have a 13-year-old, and these kids are crazy. Like, ugh. But that makes me feel better hearing that, you know, they come out kind of the other side of this, the roller coaster.
Even if they don't, like, I don't know, there's nothing you can do about it. It's really not a reflection of you, is I guess what I'm trying to say. So
yeah.
I think
it's
that
kind of
freed me up a lot.
Because they really are their own little creatures, and they always have been from the second they were born, you know? Even if we try to mess them up, we can't always succeed. Like you, I'm a total overparenter, you know. I'm always worrying and hovering over him. But I'm definitely less like that than I used to be. I am he's probably very grateful for that, because I could have been a much bigger mess than I already am.
I know. Can you imagine? Just imagine. But they are obnoxious, these boys in their teenagehood.
And they smell horrible. Oh, I can't take it anymore. I realized the other day as I was making my shopping list that I have not bought Max a bottle of shampoo in, I don't know, 5 years. And I look in his shower and his bottle is half full. And I'm thinking, what is he doing in there? Like, does he have a miraculously regenerating shampoo bottle, or is my child really not bathing? It's pretty horrifying.
Yeah. So, I pretend not to think about it, not to, yeah. We're hoping the public schools, because again, it's worse when you're homeschooled, because if you don't leave the house for 2 or 3 days, there's no one really to keep you accountable for that personal hygiene thing. So one of the things I was super excited about for the going to high school was I figure all there has to be is a hot girl on the school bus, and that should probably solve our showering.
Yep.
You know, issue.
Yep.
So
does he like it?
Yeah. I mean, in teenage terms, like, how was your day at school? Good. Did you have a good day at school? Yeah. Yeah. So, I mean, he's not refusing to get on the bus at the O Dark 100 hour 6:45 or whatever. So,
I figured
that's a good sign.
Yeah. Yeah. You got to just think that they'll let you know if something's going wrong.
Well,
sometimes.
Not all public school students have this, but, I mean, I'm still homeschooling other kids, right? So I told him, you know, it's not when he decided to try it out, go for it. If you don't like it, you know, in our family, homeschooling's still an option. So we told him, you know, you have to stick it out for a semester because we're not going to play this, like, I go for 2 days, I hate it, like, you know, I don't really give it a chance kind of thing.
Right.
But I guess in some ways he kind of does have an out. Like, if he really hated it, he could be like, I'm going to homeschool. But so far, so good. So I figure that's positive.
That's
but
awesome.
Again, I feel like honeymoon period is probably at least the first couple months. And then when he's waiting at the school bus in the actual dark, in the snow, that's real tough.
Oh, yeah. So how many are you homeschooling right now?
Just two, actually.
Okay. All right. Wow.
Super manageable. Ty's kind of like managing a couple kids, but it's still okay. And my sister lives with us now, and she has a three-year-old. So talk about like parenting, like having your second chance to parent again. I'm like, gosh, I wish I would have had this perspective on life when I was parenting toddlers 10 years ago.
Because
I remember being so flustered by toddler tantrums and just being so horrified. And I remember actually trying to get to stroller strides with two toddlers. And one particular morning, like PJ, who was really a great kid generally, but was just having a rough morning for whatever reason. And I just remember him like arching his back and not getting his car seat. And he screamed, "I'm not going anywhere with you, not to the mall, not to stroller strides, not to school," like, like on and on and on. And I just remember at the time, like, being so angry at this kid. And I remember calling my husband and being like, "I'm not going to make it through this day without killing him. And I think I'm going to drop him off at your office." And he was like 2.5. And now I'm thinking like 2.5, like whatever. Like I laugh in the face of toddler tantrums, you know, like I'm like, "You're funny." But at the time it was so like, I took it so personally and I was like,
Oh yeah. I remember I did the same thing. Oh my gosh. Oh yeah. Max would, he had asthma when he was little, and every once in a while when he had an asthma flare up, they put him on this medication, steroids, and that brought out of him what we call the rabid raccoon. And I remember we were on an airplane from Portland, Oregon to Baltimore, and Max was on the steroids and he was flipping out. I thought they were going to turn the plane around. I remember just thinking, like, I think this might be my rock bottom parenting moment, you know? And Max was flipping out and smacking us, and people kept turning around because they kept hearing the smacking noise and they thought that we were hitting him, which we were not. He was smacking us. He was trying to get away from us. And, oh my gosh, and then I think, if I went back and did that plane ride again, I would have been so much more calm. And maybe I could have actually calmed him down, you know, because I would have been like, yeah.
Right.
Bring
we kind of feed off each other. It's, it's like a bad cycle.
Yep.
For sure. Yeah. So you wrote a book. Were you always a writer what was your life before Stroller Strides? Because I feel like I met all these moms, and like all I know is that you look great in yoga pants and you can push a jogging stroller. So,
I guess I've always been a writer. I was a journalist for many years. I worked in Washington, D.C. I started out in television, but I hated it. I started at America's Most Wanted, and I did not hate that. I loved America's Most Wanted. I was an intern and then a PA, and then we got canceled, and it was such a bummer. Fox canceled the show, and then they brought it back 6 months later as America's Most Wanted, America Fights Back, because apparently there was this huge letter writing campaign from the law enforcement community. But by then, all the staff had left. A lot of them ended up at Jenny Jones, which was unfortunate for them. And then some of us ended up at ABC News. So I was there for a little bit, and then I worked for Congress Daily. So yeah, I was a journalist, and yeah, it was a lot of fun. It was definitely a life for somebody in their 20s. I remember just the crazy hours I worked, and you know, we'd come in at 5 and leave at 11, but it was fun. It was a lot of fun. And then I think it was during the whole Monica Lewinsky thing, my husband Kevin, who works in high tech, said, you know, I'm being headhunted by these companies on the West Coast in Portland and Seattle. What do you think about moving to Portland and Seattle? And I had just had, oh my gosh, I was just so sick of like all the political scandal and blah, blah, blah. And I said, you know what? Yeah, let's do it. Let's move to Portland. And 10 days later, we're on a moving van. And I'm like, I was kind of kidding about that, but sure, why not? I mean, we didn't have kids or anything, so we just moved to Portland. And I got a job at Willamette Week, or I was offered a job at Willamette Week, and they said they would pay me 15 cents a word. And I thought to myself, oh, God, I have got to get an actual job. So I became a grant writer for Oregon Ballet Theater, and I just loved it. I couldn't believe that you could get paid to write 9 to 5 and get health insurance. It was just the coolest thing ever. I loved it. So it was kind of the perfect thing at the perfect time. And I loved working for the ballet. That was just so much fun. So that's how I got into development and fundraising, kind of through that door. But I've always freelanced. When we moved back here, I started freelancing for this magazine called Grapevine, which was a wine and travel magazine. And my editor kind of figured out that I was more of a comedy writer. And so she started sending me on these crazy trips. Like, she'd call me and say, how would you like to go to the Eastern Shore with your husband to review a romantic bed and breakfast? And I'd say, oh, yeah, sign me up. And then she'd say, it's also a shooting range. And you're going to learn how to shoot skeet. I was like, oh, my God. And I mean, every single – oh, and there was the one where she sent us to Lancaster, and I had to learn how to milk a cow. I mean, every one of these was like an I Love Lucy episode. And so it was a lot of fun. But then, of course, that magazine went out of business, which still makes me sad because I love.
Yeah, that pretty much sounds like my dream job. Pretty much. Did you go? I kind of remember you posting. Did you go get paid to go to the Hershey Spa too, or was that someone else?
Yes, that was me.
Yeah, I thought so.
Oh my gosh, that was the freaking best. Loved it. Yeah. So now I'm working freelance for a few publications from Mid-Atlantic Media, Jewish Times, Smart Shopper, and Baltimore's Child. And I have a lot of fun writing those, especially the Baltimore's Child pieces. Those are a lot of fun. I get a lot of freedom to kind of write about whatever pops into my head that month. So, and this month I'm trying to collect embarrassing stories. So if you know anybody who has an embarrassing story, ways that your child has embarrassed you. So I put it on Facebook and said, you know, I'm looking for stories of ways that your kids embarrass you, et cetera, et cetera. And I said, if you send them to me, I'll tell you my most embarrassing story from when Max was little, which is the infamous Barnes & Noble incident of 2006. You know that Barnes & Noble downtown?
Yeah.
Where the power plant is?
Yeah, absolutely. So, next to the Hard Rock and
Yeah. I can never go in there again because of what Max did in 2006. So I was in the bathroom, and you know how when you bring your toddler into the bathroom, you cannot trust them to not move around for 30 seconds. So I had him, his job was to hold the door. And of course the door did not need to be held. It was locked. But, you know, if you give him a job, you know, they think, oh, this is really important, blah, blah, blah. So he's holding the door, you know, he's not going to run around. He's going to hold the door. And I hear him outside and he says, Mom, there is a horrible smell coming from somewhere in this bathroom. And I'm thinking, oh my God, I can't believe he's saying this so loudly. And some women just start laughing. And then he goes, I'm going to find where that smell is coming from. And before I could even think or do anything or just start screaming no at the top of my lungs, he is down on the floor and crawling into a woman's stall. She is screaming, and he says, Mom, I found out where the smell is coming from. And I am so horrified on so many levels. I mean, first of all, there's the crawling into somebody's bathroom stall. You know, that's horrible. And I'm screaming like, I'm sorry. And then there's the fact that he's on the floor in a public bathroom crawling. And I want to scream about that too. And then there's the fact that he's, you know, like he's illegally pursuing, you know, whatever he was pursuing in the woman's bathroom. It was just horrible on many levels. And I can never go back there ever.
Oh my gosh. That's hysterical. I can't even imagine. I mean, I'm glad you can laugh about it. It's one of those things where you like laugh about it like 100 years later, but in the moment, like you think you'd just rather die.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly.
They make family bathrooms just so that people don't have to have stories like that.
Yes. Yes. Thank goodness for those family bathrooms. Oh my gosh. Yep. So that was the worst. But now, you know, now that he's 13, it's so easy to embarrass him. All I have to do is ask about girls or say something that's, you know, not appropriate for my generation, like hashtag awesome. And he's like, Mom, stop trying to talk like you know what that means.
Like, in our family, it's open season on sex talk. Like, we just... It started with having a child in our home who didn't know what she didn't know, and she would ask questions, and then we just thought, well, you know, like, it should just be open talk anyway, because if they can't feel comfortable asking about it in our house, they're going to ask
someone
else.
Throw it out on the table. Yeah.
So... we just decided, it's kind of like a grand social experiment, that we would just kind of make it like table talk, kind of talking about the weather. It comes up often and in appropriate and then very inappropriate ways all the time. And, you know, either we're scarring our kids for life or it's going to rock. Like, it's going to just be the best thing ever.
I think that
and
is
our kids
the
are going to have
thing ever.
I mean, so far so good, but except for like one time my kid walked into the bedroom and I was like folding laundry or something, and he was like, he goes, did I hear you and Dad in the shower last night together? Like, did you shower together? And I just kind of like was off the top, like, yeah, you know, like, cause they know we do that. We don't really talk about what happens in there, but I was like, yeah, totally. And then he just like looks at me deadpan. He goes, did you have sex? And I was like, whoa, like, yeah, we're not going to be that open.
Yeah.
But thanks for asking.
Oh, no. Thanks for inquiring about the health of our marriage.
Right, right. But I will say, like, when we really want to see the kids blush, that's what we'll do. We'll, like, everyone will be watching a movie on, like, Saturday morning, and we'll be like, hey, guys, keep watching the movie. We're just going to go in the bedroom a little bit. We're going to have some Saturday morning sex. We'll be out in, like, 20 minutes. So, you know, don't knock on the door, whatever. And then, you know, they're just like, oh, Mom, do you have to say
no
that?
No way. Oh, my
but
God.
Oh, whether yeah. we're going to or not, it's just, like, fun. We're like, guys, sleeping Saturday. See you soon.
Well, you got to think when they get older and they're having, you know, crazy relationship problems in their teens and 20s, you know, they can come to you and say, is this normal? And you can say, no. Well, yeah. Or, you know, they're going to talk to you. It's not going to feel like they're opening up this giant, I don't know, wind tunnel of a conversation. Yeah, I love it. I love that approach. So
yeah, that's kind of how we roll in our family. So I'm pretty sure that if my kids ever have to share like one of their most embarrassing moments, it's probably going to revolve around, you know, my friend was over and my parents were talking about sex and I just didn't know what to do with myself.
Oh my gosh. Wow.
Yeah. In fact, we just signed the permission slip for health class for ninth grade.
Oh yeah.
And there's going to be sex talk in ninth grade because it starts in like fourth grade. So of course there's going to be sex talk in ninth grade. So my husband and all of his sarcasticness, of course, were in Utah trying to figure out how to sign sex ed papers. And I'm like, hey, you know, there's a sex ed paper we need to sign or whatever. My husband goes, what, do they want him to teach the class? I'm like, well, you know, probably.
Oh, that's awesome. That's awesome. So what were you guys doing in Utah for a week?
We were at a conference for doTERRA. I teach essential oil classes and as my job now. And so their headquarters are out there.
I am all about essential oils right now. I make my own bug spray. It's like my own personal little potions class.
You should totally come. I should add you to my Facebook group. We do free classes. We're getting ready to start weekly support groups. Support groups. We need a better name than that. Weekly oil fun potion classes. Maybe I'll call them potion classes. Anyway,
it's like, it's so much fun. It's creative and, you know, I feel like I'm doing something healthy and yeah, I love essential oils. So I just made an anti-aging serum. I have to kind of mess with the recipe. It gives me zits, so I don't know how I'm going to use it. But my bug spray is awesome.
Maybe it's working, because if you have a face full of zits, you already look amazing. But if you have a face full of zits, you could probably pass as 20 again.
Yeah, that's true. That's true. I love it. So better than wrinkles. Yeah, so I love doing that kind of stuff. I'm all about it.
Yeah, it's pretty much like our answer for everything. The ironic thing is no one else in my house except for Ty really likes them. So it's like how I'm making my livelihood right now. It's like my passion. I love oils. And people are like, so what's your favorite diffuser? And I'm like, oh, I don't really diffuse in my house because no one likes oils. That's fun. But I love them for myself. And then the running joke is, of course, there's an oil for everything. There should be an oil for everything. So that's how my kids get snarky back at me because, you know, I'll be like looking for my car keys and they're like, isn't there an oil for that?
From memory, there is. It's lemongrass.
I'm like, yes. Right. I'm like, I'm going to go sniff my rosemary and then decide and then remember where I dropped my car keys. Thank you.
Oh, that's right. It's rosemary. Okay. Yes. Lemongrass.
It might be lemongrass, too.
Oh, but rosemary is for remembering. I remember that.
Yeah.
If I had been using my rosemary, I would have remembered that before.
Exactly.
But, yeah. Oh, love it. So much fun. I just go on Pinterest and I look up these little recipes and then I make up my own.
Yeah, it's kind of like chemistry too, which I have a science background, and so I really have enjoyed also all the chemistry and the science behind why they actually work. Because my favorite like comeback to someone who's like, these are like snake oils, and I like to launch into a lecture about alcohols and sesquiterpenes and all of the chemical components and be like, oh, but... So.
Oh, yeah. Well, I mean, all of the medication they had me on during cancer, all of my chemo treatments, they were just basically plants, you know, slightly chemically altered plants. What was the worst one? The adriamycin? It was something like sage or beetroot, like this really nasty variety of sage or I can't remember. But yeah, basically, that's how medications are made, is from, you know, these plants, and pharmaceutical companies just alter them and there they go.
And then patent them.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. So.
Yeah. So that should be on your lineup for Baltimore's Child. Have you done essential oils yet?
No, I haven't. I should totally do that.
You should.
Oh, that would be fun. And then I can interview you.
For sure. I would love to.
Then the tables are turned.
Yeah. There's a whole, like, Stroller Strides Baltimore Child thing going on because Rebecca was just in Baltimore's Child, too. And way back when we adopted Ty, we were a feature Baltimore's Child. They were looking for, like, different types of families or something. They did, like, four different family highlights. And so we got the adoptive family spot.
Oh, my gosh.
So I have special love for Baltimore Child, and it's how I survived my motherhood, because that's how I knew what was going on in the world for mothers and small children, because they have a phenomenal calendar.
Yes.
And probably actually how I found Stroller Strides was probably through Baltimore Child.
Yeah. So probably me too.
Full circle now. We've all come full circle.
I know. It's amazing. It's amazing.
So, well, thank you so much for hanging out with me. I have thoroughly enjoyed catching up. We should probably have a reunion because I'm not joking.
I
found some of my best friends at Stroller Strides.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. We should definitely have a reunion. I would love to take a picture of all the kids towering over us. We're friends with all of them on Facebook. We should totally make this happen. We could do it in my backyard.
And a lot of people are still, definitely in touch. So I think let's make it happen.
Oh, my word. So now you know our house is definitely not G-rated. Plus, I'm still reliving that Barnes & Noble bathroom situation in my head and laughing out loud. I think that's where I'll be going mentally every time I think I'm having a really bad day. What about you? What is your most embarrassing parent moment ever? Do you have anything to top that infamous Barnes & Noble incident of 2006? I'm sure Erica's story she was writing is long published, but I'd love to hear your stories. You can find me on Instagram and Twitter at MACorkum. Use the hashtag #TheUncorkedPodcast so we can all follow along. Coincidentally, if you go to facebook.com/MACorkum, you'll also find me. Oh, I almost forgot. If you want to read the truth about Susie, of course you do, you can find a link to Erica's book on the show notes page at www.thequirkums.com. Lastly, will you do me a favor? Leave your feedback about the show as a review on iTunes or Stitcher. It really helps more people hear all these amazing stories. I'm so glad you joined us. Have a great week.